How does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life? That's our question. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. There has been no shortage of women's sport to follow this year. We've had the Ashes for cricket fans, the Rugby Six Nations, the Netball World Cup, and of course, the Football World Cup, which was watched by millions. Women's sport has seen a pretty radical transformation in recent decades. But problems still remain, not least in equal pay, representation in broadcasting, and sports provision in schools. How have we achieved change so far? How do we continue to narrow the gap? And what can other campaigns learn from this example of such significant cultural and behavioural change? In this Change Network event, our audience heard from three top speakers from the world of women's sport. On the panel were Ebony Rainford-Brent, who is a World Cup-winning English cricketer and now a regular broadcaster for the BBC, Kelly Simmons, who's the FA's director of the women's professional game, and Sally Hancock, managing partner of Y Sport and former chair of the charity Women in Sport. Before we heard from the speakers, the chair and our CEO, Sue Tibbles, sets the scene for us.
We thought we would start our story tonight in 1984, because that's when the Women's Sports Foundation, as it was then called, was set up in the UK. As an organisation interested in civil society campaigning, it seemed a good starting point for our conversation today. The UK Women's Sports Foundation was inspired by the American foundation of the same name. And when Women's Sports Foundation, now Women in Sport, who are also here today, was set up in 1984, just to remind ourselves, it was a time when women couldn't compete in the marathon, the 5,000 metres, triple jump, pole vault, hammer throw, steeplechase or boxing at the Olympic Games. There was no Women's Tour de France, no Women's Football World Cup. UK had never hosted an international women's rugby tournament. No female face had ever presented grandstand, offered commentary on match of the day. No female football referees. The Royal and Ancient didn't allow women onto its courses or into its locker rooms. Women were not allowed into the MCC, and no woman cricketer was named in Wisden. And there was not one single professional woman in any team sport. Today, well, we're going to hear much, much more about this. The ECB have just announced $20 million investment into the women's game with a pledge to increase it to $50 million. 11.7 million watched England play the US in the World Cup semi-final. FIFA estimate 1 billion viewers of the World Cup for the first time with over 2,200 broadcasters involved. 2.6 million watched England versus New Zealand in the 27 Rugby World Cup. Women are officiating, commentating, negotiating and so on. It really has been a spectacular change, and I'm sure all of you have followed it with just an enormous amount of pleasure. I think for me personally, it's when I'm in the supermarket and I see a troop of girls going past in football kit covered in mud that I'm most like, yes, fantastic. There is still so much more to do, but our question today is, what really has led to that change? What happened over that period to unlock women's team sport in the way that it has been? Is it the result of key individuals in leadership positions? Is it to do with more media profile? Was it pressure from fans? Was it wider societal pressure, interest from brands and sponsors, great campaigning? What actually has gone on?
So what did our speakers think had led to the changes we have seen? Ebony Rainford-Brent talks us through what it was like when she started out as an athlete and what she thinks has catalysed change. Ebony mentioned Spotty, which is the Sports Personality of the Year award.
Well, to give you a flavour, I played for this club here at Surrey from the age of 10, and when I started I was in a skirt, or almost culottes with long socks, and it was that sort of era where, if you see photos of the old girls, I was one of them. It was completely far away from where it is now. I think there's been so many reasons for change that it's hard to sort of narrow down one major one, but I'll go through a couple and then we can go. Some of them, I think without doubt, performance has been vital. So after 2009, when we won the World Cup, and it was over in Australia, although it wasn't the sort of level we've seen from the football and stuff like that, what happened is being a successful World Cup team at a time when the men weren't as well, kind of created a bit of a talking point. The women are under-resourced, but they're creating this level of success. You know, we made it onto Spotty as one of the team of the year. We didn't win. This is still a thing that still bugged me, right? We were on there, and the men, I love the men, I love, you know, but they had just won the Ashes. We'd won the World Cup, the World T20, and the Ashes all in one year. Like, I think it's impossible to repeat that. And you know, we're just a little bit sore, but I think the key thing was we were on that platform, and the success drove that. So I think without doubt that's been vital. And then some other key ones which has to be kind of one of the leading drive ones is people of influence. So I've noticed since I've been on the board at Surrey, talking about women's issues, how you can impact things quite quickly. You look at Claire Connor and what she's done for the women's game, being on the board, that's had an influence. But it's not also females, it's male advocates as well. It's people who just see the big picture. So those are two of my reasons. I've got a whole list, so I don't want to like hug the mic forever, but those are two quite key ones that I think have been vital.
Next, we heard from Kelly at the FA, who put women's sport in a broader landscape of progress for women.
Football and sport's not immune from what's going on in society. So the old days of, you know, girls playing these traditional sports and you see no female athletes on television and there's just no visibility. I think people just don't accept that anymore. I think there's pressure on governing bodies, on brands, on broadcasters to invest in women's sport. And that's been a really good pressure. I think in terms of football, it's not come cheaply where we've got to. We've invested in the pathway, invested in growing the game at all levels, getting girls into football, the talent pathway, the England teams, making a leap into professional women's football, even though it wasn't at the moment a sustainable in its own right. You know, it's that leap of faith that we think is strategically really important for the game for a whole range of reasons, and that we can build it out to be sustainable in its own right, but you know, we're investing for the long term. We've sort of, you know, through key people in the organisation, leaders who are passionate about it, like Martin Glenn, who's our chief exec, he reset the level of ambition for women's football in the organisation, and he very much drove through the level of investment. You know, there's a great Joe Biden quote about don't tell me what you value, show me your budgets and I'll tell you what you value. You know, for many years, sport talked a good game, but the levels of investment in women's sport were so pitiful that therefore that impacted on the product and therefore everything impacts from there. So now I think, you know, we've invested in the pathway, invested in England, invested in professionally. We have a fantastic product and broadcasters and brands are getting behind it and amplifying it. And now, you know, we've seen the results with the Lionesses and we're starting to see that pull through into the Women's Super League.
Kelly joined the FA in 1992. She told us what motivated her to work in sports.
Well, for me personally, I wasn't allowed to play girls' football. I thought it was a massive injustice. So we were channeled off into the sports that I saw on TV at the time, cricket, rugby, football. They were the sports I was interested in. They were the sports we talked about as a family. They were the people I sort of idolised on television. Went off to school and was told you played netball and rounders. What? I don't want to play netball. So really early I felt this sort of massive sense of injustice. I'm really passionate about football and the power of football and what opening that up to girls and women's means for society and for those girls and women. So I guess there's kind of a higher purpose, sounds a bit glib. And therefore, even though I've worked across male and female football and now more recently gone back to leading the women's professional game, you know, I passionately, there's nothing for me more powerful than when opening game of the season, I went to Chelsea Spurs, it was over 20,000. The Tube is packed with young boys and young girls with shirts on, with the Chelsea women players on. That for me is really, it sends a really important message, a bit of sort of society of celebrity and Kardashians, that these are incredible, strong, athletic, fantastic role models that society needs. Mm-hmm. And sport, my God, doesn't society need sport and all that it brings more than ever. Mm-hmm. So I'm massively passionate about it. I think football's got its incredible power and I was just doggedly determined to open it up to the 50% who've been excluded from it.
Next up, Sally told us why she thinks things have changed from a branding and sponsorship perspective.
I've worked in this sector for a long time, with the marketing sponsorship sector. And I can recall sort of back in the day when I was you know, running and working in a couple of sponsorship agencies, we were often asked by brands to explore perhaps partnership opportunities for them that would reach women. And the default position all the time was Cancer Research, Race for Life, always. Because it was the only event at that time that was focused on women with a female participant base, addressing issues that were close to women, the heart of women. And we knew that it would reach and target well into that audience. And it took a long, long time, really, for various of the governing bodies to realise that it was no longer an appropriate thing to bundle the rights to the women's aspects of their sport in with the men's, just to throw it in, you know. Because whenever that happened, nothing was ever done with those assets. So what took a sort of major change from our perspective was the decision by the FA to separate its women's and men's partnership rights out in order to enable new brands to come in. Mm. I had been working on the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow with the energy company SSE, and they came to the end of their partnership and had had this epiphany, if you like, that all of the other sponsorships, the events and activities they sponsored through their brand, all of them were male-focused. It was golf, and it was rugby, and it was a bit of football, and it was a bit of cricket here and there, but it was very, very male-centric. And their realisation on two things. One, that the majority of decisions on the decision-maker in a household that chooses the energy supplier is almost always the woman. Major moment. And the second thing, the realisation that actually perhaps they could do something quite radical and different. So the long and the short of all that was that SSE put its cards on the table and decided to put all of its efforts behind women's sport with a partnership with the FA for the Women's FA Cup, to become the title sponsor of that for 4 years, to work with Kelly and the team, to get commitment from Wembley that the event would be held there, to get commitment from the BBC that it would be broadcast live on that channel. And all of a sudden, women's sport was in the spotlight in a major way. In addition to that, SSE also, you know, we advised that to really make a difference, why not actually get in at the base as well and increase the number of opportunities for young girls to play football? Because it was so restricted at the time. What we've now seen since is, you know, any number of brands following suit, some with really good intent, I would say, some perhaps simply wanting to tick off the diversity tick box in their corporate report, but others who are committed and recognise too that actually activating and engaging with women through sport and activity is a very, very good way of making change in society.
Brands and sponsors have clearly played a huge role, who are in turn probably responding to social norms. So what role has public pressure played in the transformation of women's sport? And where have incidents of discrimination and prejudice caused such outrage that they have propelled change forwards? Here's Ebony again.
It's a really interesting topic, you know, personal experience that my whole career, everyone else did. I think it's, you know, you go into the performance centre where the men and women train and you're being asked, you know, you're here to cook, you know, all those sort of things. We've seen it. What's really fascinating now for me is the flip side where people, men specifically, who were making derogatory comments have seen the uplift of the women's game and all of a sudden have jumped on the bandwagon. Whether it's genuine, who knows? I don't really care, as long as you're on the right message. And I think a lot of that, actually, some of it, if I'm honest, you know, you look at our sport in cricket, the performance standards, they maybe weren't there because the investment wasn't there. And so, you know, as that has driven and gone through the roof, and you see more women training in similar environments to the guys, and that you see those perceptions change. So some of it, you know, fair play. The women maybe didn't always have that standard, but they didn't have the investment. And actually, I'll say I've come across many women who also had beliefs that women shouldn't be stepping up. I've got people who are school teachers who have told me their beliefs, which are the girls, this isn't for them, and, you know, maximum is stallball, and that's it. And even that seemed like a stretch. So I think you're going to get left behind now if you're not on the movement. And it's been really nice to see the shift that's taken place over the last, for me, it's been 20 years. I did a talk in a school last week and I played a video. It's a short one narrated by Billie Jean King, and it says, "Dear Little Girl." Check it out on YouTube, it's really powerful. But the one message that I kept saying to the girls is, I don't think there's a better time to be a woman, and I feel that. And, you know, I think a lot of us are telling, you know, every time they see a Lucy Bronze or they see a Claire Connor in a powerful position, they look up now and they see it. I think there's times where I've gone into school and you might see Nicola Sturgeon at the same time, Theresa May, and, you know, you're saying, if you're a woman, everything is possible. And so I think they believe it because they're starting to see it. And then when you see people like me reminding them that it wasn't always that way, yeah. It's massive change. And I feel this is kind of the real point now to kick on. Exponential change is what I want to see.
Kelly agreed that one of the drivers for change has been the framing of women's sport as an exciting opportunity rather than an issue of compliance.
Internally, I think I still go back to 2015 when the Lionesses won the bronze medal in Canada. The men's team weren't doing so well. I think, you know, definitely the public fell in love with the Lionesses, and internally people were so proud of them that they couldn't do enough to help. It was almost like a sort of wake-up moment. We've got this fantastic role models, these fantastic ambassadors, this brilliant team who would sort of, you know, move, flying up the rankings, and also the potential for the game is quite in its infancy in terms of its investment and its structures. The potential is enormous. So yeah, absolutely, I think, you know, whether people believe wholeheartedly in our brand purpose for all, or whether it's because you think my job is to grow participation and we've got an untapped 50%, and that's the biggest growth area, or whether my job is to sell tickets and there's a massive, you know, fill up Wembley Stadium, which by the way we're about to fill out for the Lionesses. You know, the business case is obvious and compelling, and you know, broadcasters, brands, fans, not just women's fans, because a lot of men, more men watch women's football than women. But also, it does open up new audiences to clubs in the FA.
This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. We're looking at the transformation of women's elite sports. Taking part are Ebony Rainford Brent, cricketer and broadcaster, Kelly Simmons from the FA, and Sally Hancock, an expert in commercial sponsorship in sport. Sally talked to us about growing audience demand and the important role that parents play.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So that was a sort of clear message we were hearing before. The fact that so many of the major events are now visible, we've had great success in, you know, in the Olympic Games and in Commonwealth Games and other team events as well, where we've been able to shine a light on one or two spots of sports that don't commonly receive it, has definitely seen an upsurge. There is clearly a link between the enthusiasm and support of parents who encourage that interest in their children, whether they're boys or girls, to see and watch women's sport. And we recognise as well that enabling and communicating the opportunities for participation around that too at that time are crucial. So it's the audience is growing. We saw that with the Lionesses this year. And the size of the audience, the diversity of that audience, it just took all of our previous challenges and assumptions. For a moment there, it looked as though we had cracked that. And I really hope that now we can continue to see that quality of production and performance leading to participation and more, you know, more fandom going forward.
Kelly Simmons.
The coverage of women's football, the change has been quite remarkable. And we had 235 major articles on the launch weekend of the Women's Super League. The Telegraph did a 12-page spread. I mean, it was just unprecedented levels of coverage. You know, we worked really hard to make sure that all the media partners had got right access to the players, and we gave them really good content. But they've backed us and covered the Women's Super League in levels that we couldn't have, you know, probably dreamt of 2 or 3 years ago, where it was only really England or Women's Cup final get any coverage. So it's shifted massively.
Sally Hancock.
And I think as well, we must remember the Netball World Cup this year, which drove, you know, such great television audiences via the red button. And the interest that flowed from that, the coverage was brilliant. The interest in terms of finding a club near me, or where do I go to play, interest in, you know, walking netball, and the whole spectrum of the sport just shot up afterwards. There's your answer, you know. If you can see it, you can be it.
As a pundit for the BBC's Test Match Special and Five Live, Ebony told us about the changes she's seen in broadcasting.
I hope everybody saw the BBC campaign this year, Be a Game Changer. And I was fortunate to be on it. There was Alex Scott, Gabby Logan. But that was signalling another change, isn't it? That the broadcasters see there's enough sport that they're now broadcasting across a range of different areas, that netballers were involved and stuff like that, and then the whole campaign. It's amazing to see the change. I think what I've noticed, I have to up my skills. I think when I first started and you commentated, you knew nobody knew anything. You could make up a stat. You could say, you know, they scored 1,000 runs and no one's going to check it. Now, if you get anything wrong, fans are on you. You can mispronounce a name and you're under pressure. And, you know, you do have to up your game because the audiences are growing. We saw in cricket, 2017, so recently the women won the World Cup. And that shifted so many things behind the scenes because there was a packed out Lords, the broadcast numbers, it went on to Sky Sports Mix, BBC covered it, and the numbers again went through the roof. But what's been really interesting, and I'm kind of going big, big picture to come back to the English landscape, we found ICC, so they're the global cricket organisation. We have the ECB here, FA, etc. India played England in that final, and India have, what, billions of people? I don't know what the population is, but billions. And they, as a result of seeing packed Lords, billions of people watching around the world, and them getting behind the audience, conducted a bit of global research, and they found actually the global drive for women's cricket and the appetite is higher than many levels of Test cricket, men's ODIs. So they've shifted and decided globally their commercial deals, World Cups, they just announced that prize money is going through the roof. I think it's gone up 20 times for a World Cup because they see the big picture of the appetite of what people want to watch. And all they want to watch is high quality sport. Men or women, they don't care, it's high quality. And so great news if you're a broadcaster, hopefully I can stay in this career for a little while. But what is amazing to see is it's not just here. Sometimes I think we forget and we see our local audience. But seeing that insight around the world, they want to see success and they believe women are part of that. It's really exciting.
And how important is it to have women in top jobs in the sports world, setting an example?
I think it's vital. I don't think it's necessary. I think as long as someone, you know, I've seen like many men make big change. But yeah. I do think the perspective is different. I think when I've been in rooms and heard conversations, different angles and having to understand the experience as well. I think that is quite important. If you're trying to create a vision that's going to appeal to women, a bunch of men deliberating it, I'm sure they may be as switched on as anybody, but you have to have the experience. I also think there's a little bit, you kind of alluded to it, Kelly, about a fire in the belly of, you know, what the opportunities we didn't have. And I think sometimes, you know, when I see Barbara Slater at work, for example, she's someone who's got that kind of gusto behind her. And I wonder if part of that drive and ambition comes from knowing what it was like in a previous generation. So I think a couple of those factors come together. It's important that women are at the top table making those decisions.
The changes we have seen for women in sport are pretty remarkable. But there is still a lot of work to do, particularly at a grassroots level. For children at secondary school, only 16% of boys and 8% of girls are meeting recommended levels of physical activity. So what do our speakers want to see happen next? Kelly Sebbins first.
So I think, and I touched on this earlier, I think the big challenge for women's sport now is I think we've cracked the big events. So, you know, Olympics, World Cups, valuable media rights, brands getting behind it, high visibility. But then most sports disappear for sort of 2 or 4 years, depending on what's in their cycle in terms of major competitions. Whereas the big men's sports are week in, week out. And, you know, one of the reasons that I sort of jumped to taking this job is I passionately believe that the Women's Super League can be that breakthrough in terms of high visibility, commercial sustainability, growing and big audiences and attendances. And I'm convinced we can get there pretty quickly.
And what does Kelly think the variety is like in the football world? Are some clubs lagging behind?
Clubs are on a kind of on a journey from the women's clubs completely independent and carries the name right through to, you know, the Arsenals, Man City's, Chelsea's of this world, which are fully integrated and have got the access and expertise of their commercial departments, their marketing departments, their, you know, their CRM databases. You know, they're completely embedded. And the only way that women's football is going to, well, it is professional, but professionalised and be sustainable, and I think we can get there in sort of 5-7 years in terms of a sustainable, profitable league, is to have access to that kind of expertise. The workforce and the access to expertise is fundamental to shifting the dial, and clubs are on that journey, and we're trying to influence them.
What did Sally think needs to happen next?
If I had a crystal ball, my thoughts on this sector going forward, we will continue to see more and more brands recognising the value of partnering with sport, and particularly women's sport, and an activity that reaches a wider audience of families and girls as well. The ingenious brands are starting to do that now. It's all very well labelling a sports event, but what I would really like to see more of is really good activation and really taking the spirit and the principles of the event that you sponsor right down through the line to schools, to products, to the back of cereal packets, to get the message out that actually sport is a great thing for girls And by the way, you love this sport, here's how you can get involved and how you can get organised around it.
Kelly discussed the link between corporate sponsorship and the grassroots.
So we've recently signed a deal with Barclays as title sponsor of the Women's Super League, and they're really investing and helping us to go on that, you know, the journey we just talked about. They, again, as have other brands that we've been speaking to who are starting to come into the women's football space, very much want to support the whole of the game. So in Barclays' case, they are investing significantly in our ambition to have football in every girls' football in every school in the country. We've got brands that very much want to invest in the top of the game, but make sure they're investing in the community as well, as part of that brand purpose and being able to connect in local communities and add values.
So commercial investment is a component, but Ebony had some other ideas too.
Lots of things I'd like to see, and I echo that investment into the grassroots game. I think I would, if I could, put 70% into the grassroots now. I think that momentum is with the professional game, and I think that the grassroots is where it's at. Mm. But other things I think are really interesting topics around equal pay, where everybody believes. I don't think, if I'm honest with you, I don't think we're there or should force something, but I think the ambition towards moving to a place where enough commercial income comes in that you can move that dial when it comes to pay. What's interesting, I look at our sport, for example, is, you know, the top 20, they get paid very well now. You know, I don't think any of them will be complaining, but there's a huge drop off. There's just been an announcement that 40 new contracts are going to be brought into the game. So what that's going to do for domestic cricket, the level of international cricket, is going to be a game changer. What's really interesting, though, is if we hold back from not paying our athletes at the high rate, what Australia have done is they made a decision to go all in a few years ago. They launching loads of things around maternity. They're giving 12 months pay to players. They decided to equal all prize money. They did all that investment. And this summer, our England women got wiped the floor with by Australia. They were much fitter, quicker, more switched on. They were talking about empowerment message. And I think the competitive advantage is, you know, we sometimes just think about us, but if India, who have a lot of money when it comes to our sport, if Australia keep doing what they're doing, it actually gives you a competitive advantage if you decide to really invest. So they've decided, they announced something earlier this year that they want to break that cycle of waiting for commercial investment to pay the players to increase, and they've decided to go the other way, and they're going to fund any loopholes to make sure that the players are at that highest level so they continue to dominate. Part of this, us announcing having to invest, Claire Connor and lots of people have been quite open that if we lag behind in investing, paying players better, paying the performance environment, waiting for the commercial money to come in, then actually you lose a competitive advantage.
Sally Hancock again.
It's been a sort of monumental time for women's sport in the last sort of 2 years. Mm. It's transformational. I think the only way is up from here. I'm hoping that we will see a new set of stats, a new set of data in another couple of years, Sue, that show that complete change in coverage, in the investment by brands, in the number of girls participating, in the increase in the choice that girls have in the sports they play in schools. But I think the only way is up from here. I do feel that we're on a good path now, and I think we have put the right interventions in place to make sure that the things that we have grown up with and we've seen in our lives, I think those are now in the past, and I feel very confident about women's sport looking forward.
So far, we have been talking about progress for women in terms of those who were assigned female at birth. Looking to the future, one of the clear questions in elite sporting is the inclusion of trans women. So what did our speakers think about how the sports world is responding to this challenge?
It's such a toxic debate, isn't it, this, in the public domain? Either side, kind of, on the debate, sort of slams each other in a way that means you can't have a kind of, don't feel like you can have a really proper debate at times. I mean, in terms of the FA, you know, as I mentioned earlier, our brand purpose is for all. Our priority is to enable everybody to play. And therefore, you know, we've developed our policies with Stonewall, with gendered intelligence, pride in sport. We've got a trans policy which is focused on inclusion. You know, there's various partners and medical processes in place to ensure that anybody is, I suppose, apportioned to male or female football, and that's appropriate based on where they're at. But it feels like a lot of research, a lot of really tough debate needs to happen in terms of elite sport. Women's sport, but I say it's quite brutal out there when it does come up.
I think that word you just said about research is vital. I think there's two parts of the equation. There's the participation and widening more people, more access to the sport is vital. I think there is actually a little bit of a gap in really understanding the different people, the different needs, and also sort of when it comes to performance as well, where those lines are drawn. So I'm someone who believes in inclusivity and opening up the door, but I do think that there has been an issue, and I think actually a few of us in our sport globally as well, it's been caught a little bit short of not having clear and transparent communication and understanding. So for me, that's the next stage, is sort of getting that right so everybody understands and is on the right page.
It's got to start with everybody being able to play sport, isn't it? Inclusion is so fundamental for what we want to achieve.
You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review and share it with a friend or colleague. You might also be interested in our Influencing Change programme, which starts in January 2020. Find out more at www.smk.org.uk.